Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, special kids table edition. Reason Junior, it's just for me. That's right, there are no adults in the room today. I am Robbie Suave, joined by Liz Wolf, Zach Weissmuller, and Reem Ibrahim, my colleagues at Reason Magazine. We've taken over. We've deported the adults to Siberia or Argentina or somewhere. I'm not quite sure which, but for once, this podcast will be blessedly free of elder, millennial, Gen X, boomer drama. We're going to get some young people's perspectives today. So let's get to it. Let's start with our first story, which is President Trump once again calling for FCC action against a perceived critic. This time it is NBC's Meet the Press host, Kristen Welker. Kristen or Kirsten? I always say that one wrong. Trouble with my Kirstens and Kristens. She described Donald Trump's endorsement record in the midterms as mixed. He took some umbrage to that in a True Social post, writing, "Because of this purposeful inaccuracy, she will be reported to the FCC for rebuke or punishment. The press is a disgrace to our nation, blah, blah, blah. I hope that Chairman Brendan Carr and the fine people of his commission will take this threat to our country very seriously." So that's not so good. Zach, I'll come to you first because you and I did a lot of writing about, warning about threats from former President Joe Biden's administration to police, speech critical of the government on COVID and some other subjects. I have a feeling you're going to agree that this is very much in that same tradition, despite Donald Trump running on a very pro-free speech platform commitment. Is cajoling the FCC to go after a critic a good thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's worse in a sense because it's so blatant. At least they were, the Biden administration was a little bit sneaky and backdoor about it. Maybe that's better, I don't know, so that we can react to it. But yeah, it's all part of Trump's like Europeanization of American politics, which he did so successfully by marrying social conservatism and economic progressivism. And like, it's all part of, I mean, this impulse goes back to his first campaign when he was talking about opening up the libel laws, and that didn't get much traction. And so he went the FDR route and used the FCC as using the FCC to bully critical voices by weaponizing it. FDR did that for critics on the radio of the New Deal and bullied them off the air. We don't obviously want to be like Europe in so many ways, but especially on speech, and the FCC is just another threat to that and should be abolished as soon as possible.
Yeah, it is certainly not the case that this is the first time the president of the executive has done something like this. I think Trump is distinguished by like how obvious and brazen it is, right? The previous administrations would be having their low-level bureaucrats investigate companies, send them threatening letters, not just like literally tweeting it out or blasting it out on Truth Social. That, of course, doesn't make it better. Liz, you know, I think you and I are people who try not to, you know, have TDS or set our hair on fire about every little stupid thing Donald Trump does, because sometimes people making those arguments are coming with like an implicit sort of suggestion that if we just got rid of Donald Trump, then there would be no more threats to our liberties or our free speech or our economic liberties, which is like obviously and profoundly not the case. But even so, you know, he does something like this and it's like, okay, man, this is... just don't. I don't know.
Your hair, and hopefully mine, is simply too good to set on fire, Robbie. I assume you were fishing for a compliment there. No, I think you're totally correct. I mean, trying to take Welker's comments at sort of face value, the actual point she was making was actually rather interesting. Of the, I think it's like 10 races where Trump, they're so far in the 2026 sort of Republican primary season, there have been 10 candidates, I believe, by my count, who had the Trump endorsement and yet still lost their primaries. This is a worse record this primary season than Trump has faced in the past. And if Trump had even an iota of self-reflection, he would be interested in trying to interrogate why exactly this is. He's slipping, right? And if he actually valued, you know, the Trump moment enduring, which he seems to, you would think that this would be a cause for a little bit more reflection. But no, of course, when he has the ability to sic the FCC on his opponents and his enemies, why not? We saw this happen a little bit with Jimmy Kimmel, who I personally absolutely hate. We saw this happen a little bit with Stephen Colbert and the FCC going after both of them. And it's very frustrating to me because with a lot of these folks, it's like I want them to fail on their own merits because they absolutely suck and they're the most boring, unentertaining people on the face of this earth. But it's so lame, right? Like, let them die in natural deaths.
Being obsessed with them. Being obsessed with them is also lame because Trump actually understood that the future is the alternate media, is the realm of commentary that exists totally unregulated by the FCC. That's why this is so like petty and small, because who cares what this cable news show says, this failing comedian says. People are getting their news and commentary from such a diverse realm of information. And Trump understood that by going on Joe Rogan, by, you know, doing the podcast circuit, that it's no longer the case that five large companies control the discourse and therefore, right, that it's important to control what they say or that they matter at all. But now he's like playing into that again because he wants their approval.
Trump's instincts are good. Like what you're talking about, Trump understanding the appeal, the innate appeal of Joe Rogan in our current media landscape. Like, yes, Trump is correct. But his pettiness is also showing, right? Because he's refusing to let any of these sort of old school phenomena die natural deaths. I do think, though, that one thing that we have to pay attention to is like it's just a symbiotic relationship, right? Like Trump has everything to gain by attacking mainstream media, Meet the Press anchors, and Meet the Press has everything to gain by, you know, continuing to be rather critical of Trump. And like, I think in this case, they were actually very warranted in saying, hey, look, there have been almost a dozen candidates who've secured the endorsement who are in fact losing their races. This is kind of interesting. But, you know, they also did lose some credibility over time because they've spent the better part of the last decade freaking out about Trump over and over and over again. That said, everyone stands to gain here, right?
Yeah. Reem, you are from Europe, are you not? Maybe you can speak to...
Apologies, Reem.
How this kind of thing...
We don't want to be like you.
Zach was criticizing my home country, which is terrible. But of course, there are plenty of things to criticize because free speech is something that is absolutely under threat in Europe. But what's interesting about, I think what Liz said is absolutely right. Everybody has something to gain here. I don't think it is the case that the FCC are going to have to go after NBC. But of course, it doesn't matter, right? This is the mainstream media is no longer the mainstream media, which is why I find it absolutely astronomical that Trump has basically highlighted these journalists and made them extraordinarily far more famous than they were 5 minutes ago by pointing them out and by trying to say that he's going to get the FCC on them. I also found the chart and data that he posted absolutely hilarious. So the 98% of the candidates that he endorsed had won their elections, which just like isn't true. And I think that they're all, you know, I think it's pretty accurate to describe his endorsement successes as mixed. You know, some of them won and some of them didn't. And I think that it's pretty accurate to say that. I do think the sort of more broader point here, though, is that the more and more we see politics go into this particular sort of pathway in which it is acceptable for the president to effectively say what speech is acceptable and what isn't, which is, you know, it's undoubtedly protected by the First Amendment. And even if what this particular news anchor said was incorrect, it would still be protected by the First Amendment. And the FCC has historically, to my understanding, been pretty hesitant to get involved in this particular type of speech, even if it is the case that that particular thing that was said was inaccurate or misguided. And I hope that I can sort of give some perspective on this and what that looks like in Europe. Because a lot of these countries will often use their equivalent to the FCC. So in the UK, it's Ofcom. And they will use that to say, well, we are going to stamp out on misinformation. And when they do that, they end up also stamping out on what should be protected speech, which is often just opinion. And to say that these particular consequences of this particular outcome is mixed is, you know, quote unquote, it's an analysis, right? It's opinion, it's objective. You can say it's mixed or not mixed. But also, quite crucially, if we go down this pathway in which we accept politicians attempting to suppress speech in this particular instance, because it might not be favorable to the president, then we are going down the European path, which none of us want.
Yeah, Zach, you mentioned a minute ago the possibility of just abolishing the FCC. It would seem to me that that is more doable than ever, right? Because who cares if these places are fair or what?
Yeah, the point you were raising about the dominance of digital media kind of itself makes the FCC obsolete. Like, okay, so they need to regulate bandwidth. They don't even need to do that. Just auction it off, sell it off. The property rights to the bandwidth can be adjudicated in courts, and then no content restrictions whatsoever. People can just decide what they want to hear or watch. It's an obsolete institution, and I really do think it represents more of a threatening tool the way it can be weaponized than anything useful at this point.
Okay, question though, isn't it already dying, right? Because fewer and fewer things fall sort of under its purview.
Yeah. Exactly.
Like,
yeah.
YouTube shows are not regulated. Like, this show is not regulated by the FCC, and therefore, like, great freedom lies in this. In a sense, we've already abolished the FCC in our hearts, right?
Right. And that shows how pointless it is, because even the people consuming this, Christian Welker's interviews with Trump or Jimmy Kimmel's content, are more likely going to be doing it like clips of it on social media and on YouTube, right? So the way people, most people are going to consume these pieces of content constructed in this environment in the future is going to be on the thankfully, blessedly, happily, largely unregulated internet. So it's less important. Like, I would have still been against it, but I would have seen the argument for, well, there's only these five channels and only five companies can have them. And so we're going to have something. It's so finite, we're having something short of a free market. Here are some rules and regulations they need to follow, and then adjudicating whether that was consistent with the First Amendment. Now that's totally pointless, because anyone can compete for your time and attention and influence with the people who own that broadband. Like, it just doesn't matter anymore.
What does it actually say about the Republican Party as a whole, though? Because a lot of people are still particularly supportive of the sort of MAGA cause within the party. And the fact that we have the President of the United States openly calling on a federal regulator to suppress particular types of speech that he deems unacceptable or unlikable, you know, what does that say about where sort of freedom and free speech in itself sits within the broader sort of, whether you want to call it fusionist or conservative libertarian marriage, where does that fit? Because if it is the case that there are increasing calls for suppression of freedom of expression, or indeed suppression of what is quite frankly acceptable political speech, and it's undoubtedly true that it is accepted and protected under the First Amendment, where does that take conservatism?
Well, but it's hard to say what's Trump bluster versus what's legit and actionable and going to be truly taken seriously by the FCC. Note that on Truth Social, right before this, Trump was posting like AI-generated graphics about bombing or striking Karg Island. So there's just some amount of like, this was also, remember when he made the whole tourism video for the Gaza Strip turned into Trump real estate Wonderland? I mean, it's tough because I do want to have some sort of standard of decorum for presidents. But I do also think we're pretty far past that. And at least this, I feel like, is where people sometimes get into real Trump derangement syndrome, is like, yeah, he tweets absolutely insane stuff he truth socials it, you know, a million times a day. And just as the AI generated nonsense about him bombing Karg Island is not necessarily reality or going to become reality anytime soon or in the way that he envisions, it's also not clear to me that the FCC is actually going to be doing this.
Yeah, well, since you brought up Iran, let's just spend a few quick minutes on an update on that war. I mean, we did engage in new strikes with Iran over the weekend. You know, this is something that was sold to the American people after they had already decided to do it. Trump trying to justify it, saying, making a variety of excuses, need to stop their nuclear program, you know, desire to overthrow the regime, desire to protect America and Israel from imminent terrorist threat, and it'll be very quick, and it won't cost us very much. Don't worry, don't panic, don't be a panican, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, so on and so forth. It has now gone on longer than any of the backers of it said it would go on, with Iran seemingly not willing to play ball, which is why you see this increasing. I agree with you that it's bluster. But is that even helpful? If they're just waving it off, they're saying, yeah, Trump's never going to do any of these you know, deranged things he's talking about on True Social. So we're just not going to treat it as serious. I don't see how that seems to me like something that maybe has been compromising our national security if our adversaries don't take seriously anything the president says because he's just saying crazy stuff. Seems bad to me. And seems like it's going to be a real problem for at least some of the MAGA base is expressing frustration. His poll numbers are down. I think it's to the point where it is going to really, really, really hurt, maybe sink the Republicans in the midterms. What do you think, Zach?
Yeah, I mean, clearly it's going to sink Republicans in the midterms. And I mean, everyone is kind of feeling the effects of this every time, they go to the grocery store or whatever, fill up their car. So that's, I think, that's going to hurt that hurt Biden. It's going to hurt Trump coming up. And I think that you were right, Robbie, to zero in on, like, we have to remember, like, how we were sold this in the first place.
Don't worry. It'll be over so fast. It's basically done already. We did the hard part.
J.D. Vance literally said there would be no chance this would lead to a long war right before the strikes happen. Trump was telling the Iranian people that freedom is right at hand. The regime's on its last legs. Rubio said it's about destroying ballistic missiles and the naval forces. And none of this really has come to pass in the way that it was sold. And meanwhile, our stockpiles have taken a hit, and Trump's giving speeches telling everyone, you know, the expensive gas is, that's just the price of neutering Iran, which we haven't really done. So I just hope it's kind of people remember that this is how war propaganda works. It's sadly quite effective in the short term. And there's no check on presidential war power. So there's nothing really to stop this dangerous and potentially ruinous situation from happening over and over again.
There was some literal war propaganda going on, I believe. There was a report I saw over the weekend that the Hegseth, the Pentagon, have actually been paying some influencers who are aligned with the administration to be super excited about the trajectory of the war and all of that. I mean, I think it's fine if people feel that way for them to share that. I don't think the government has any business paying them. If you can't, like, sell people on what's happening on its merits. And I was trying to adopt a wait and see attitude because I don't know. Okay, what do I know? Maybe they have some brilliant plan to bring freedom to Iran. They should still, obviously, should be voting on it. We can't just, like, go to war with a country without our Congress having oversight of it, in my view. And then they tried to take the position that if we pause the war, that resets this clock for until congressional oversight is needed. That seemed ludicrous to me. But now we've been shown again and again and again, never get hoodwinked by this stuff, that the timeline for these wars wrapping up is just never what they say it's going to be. And people get tricked by it all the time. It's very frustrating.
Have you guys considered that the worst possible case scenario is that the future is not principled anti-war, sort of more classic conservatives taking power in the future, but rather Marjorie Taylor Greene, right? Like, have you considered that the future of the Republican Party, if the sort of Trump side loses out to the more foreign policy, like interventionist skeptic types, like, it could be time for this new right-wing populism ascendant type thing? Because Marjorie Taylor Greene very much disagreed with Trump and said basically, hey, I used to support you, but you broke your promises, specifically in the realm of war and foreign policy. And I think for the last 10 years or so, I feel like whatever the darkest possible political reality is that we can go into, that's the one we choose collectively. And so I guess the thing that I always go to is like, well, what if we don't get what libertarians want, which would be, you know, conservatives who believe in ensuring that there's congressional authorization of wars and trying to have some foreign policy restraint? But what if instead we get Marjorie Taylor Greene, you guys?
Well, you chatted with her, Robbie. What's your impression of that future?
I did chat with her.
Does she have enough riz?
Nice lady. We don't agree on everything. Certainly, she was very disappointed to learn that I had received the COVID vaccine and numerous boosters. She was deeply concerned for my health. Look, I think this coalition that she was a part of and Thomas Massie was a part of and Tucker Carlson was a part of, trying to press the administration, you know, what Donald Trump ran on, no new wars. It seems like that marriage is coming to an end, as it sometimes happens, and that those people are now increasingly on the outside of the MAGA club, right? I mean, Tucker Carlson called for Donald Trump, like, to be impeached over the weekend if he's going to do a nuclear attack or something like that. I don't think, yeah, regardless of one's...
Like a cat. He has nine lives, right? He's only burned through, like, seven of them.
But regardless of one's... Maybe he's even correct that Trump should be impeached about this, but... Like, in the Republican Party, I know that 99% of Republicans don't share that view. So I think I'm wondering if it's the end of this kind of anti-war stuff being part of the Democratic or being part of the Republican Party. Now, of course, the Democratic Party also has no interest in actual non-interventionism, as they demonstrate every time they're in charge. It's just interventionism for different reasons. But I'm becoming very pessimistic about the possibility for a libertarian-based interventionism to be a dominant strain in MAGA, or even a strain whatsoever. I think it's now outside of MAGA and a little bit outside of both parties.
Well, it's definitely outside of most sort of the main political parties, main strands of both the Democrats and the Republicans, because as you said, Robbie, both parties do see a need to intervene in these particular instances. But also, you know, the way in which we were sort of convinced that this war was supposed to be a good thing is that we were told that Iran were a genuine threat to the West and that the entire point of this particular intervention was to ensure that they didn't have nuclear capabilities and that they weren't able to be a threat to the West. And what we've seen is that sort of those particular so-called aims, if you can even call them sort of sophisticated and sort of straightforward aims, those aims, even if they were aims, have not been achieved. And so in some ways, we may have even caused sort of even more reason for intervention in the future, because if Iran is now rebuilding their capabilities, they didn't have the incentive to do so before the airstrikes last summer. So now they have every reason to. Now we've aggravated all of those other partners to do so. And so in some ways, we've sort of aggravated and exacerbated the sort of political instances globally, which means that America will always have a reason to intervene somewhere. That's what we've caused this year, right? America will always have a reason to go to war. And I think that that's what we're going to see.
Right. And we've unfortunately decided that that will be entirely at the discretion of the president without any sort of congressional checks along the lines of what our founders intended, unfortunately. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll be back in a minute with more Reason Roundtable Special Kids Edition.
Hey, Reason Roundtable listeners. AI is coming for your job. Can you compete? Reliance College invites students and young professionals to AI-proof you. This is a program built to develop the skills that no algorithm can automate. AI can generate answers, it can automate tasks, but what it can't replace is human judgment or responsibility or leadership. AI-proof you trains exactly those capacities through deep Socratic analysis of great texts. Over 10 weeks, you'll start with a 3-day intensive Chicago. You'll continue with 6 online seminars drawing on Aristotle, Adam Smith, and Ayn Rand. And then you're going to finish with an in-person capstone presenting your own work. This is not a coding boot camp. As one investment banker on the advisory panel put it, judgment is not going out of style. Next cohort begins October 2nd, so discover the education built for the age of AI. Visit reliancecollege.org/AI. That's reliancecollege.org/AI.
And we're back. Okay, sticking with the theme of free speech online, definitely wanted to get into this one. Meta has settled its lawsuit with multiple states' attorneys general for $17 billion. This is the lawsuit over purported harms to children with the products Facebook and Instagram, something that has become a major point of contention or argument, whether you accept the claims of all these state figures trying to lay a lot of blame at Mark Zuckerberg's feet. Zuckerberg, in his basically conceding to the points and paying out this money, is trying to get cajole, strong arm, YouTube and TikTok as well to accept the new limitations that Facebook and Instagram are going to place on the technology regarding usage by children and teenagers. this is a victory of sorts, certainly for the people who say things like this is akin to big tobacco. This is massively harmful, that sort of thing. I've been very skeptical of many of those claims. I've had Elizabeth Nolan Brown at Reason and others. Liz, I think you have, Liz Wolf, the Liz who's with us today, I think you have somewhat of a different perspective on this. I know you headlined your kind of recap of what was going on, like Jonathan Haidt.
Jonathan Haidt's moment, yeah.
Yes. You want to start with us, start with how you feel about it, and then we'll get into a broader discussion.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for a long time when I was a baby libertarian and young in years, I basically thought that it was just absolutely ridiculous that the state could possibly make it so that children couldn't buy alcohol and buy cigarettes. And basically, I really had this very expansive idea of like the state ought to never prevent anybody of any age from sort of doing exactly what they want to do. And over time, I think, especially from raising kids and from complaining about the kids these days with Zach, one of my favorite pastimes, I've really come to a, I think, richer understanding that libertarianism is for adults. It is not for children. And it is important that in our society, especially if we want libertarianism to be taken seriously, which I very much do, we draw some clear lines there. And I think it's perfectly reasonable to defend, you know, one consistent specific age of adulthood. Like, I think 18 is perfectly reasonable. And it's frustrating the degree to which we increasingly have this patchwork where, you know, some people are interested in allowing sales of vapes at, you know, age 21, or some people have been talking about raising the voting age to age 25. And no, I think we should have consistency and establish a very clear line and boundary. But in keeping with this idea that libertarianism is for adults, I'm pretty excited about a lot of the things that Meta is going to be, yes, forced to do as a result of this settlement. You know, some of the specifics: teenagers will be limited to just 2 hours a day on Instagram and Facebook unless a parent proactively goes into the settings to give them permission for more time. Younger users are going to be restricted from using apps between midnight and 6 a.m., and notifications will be silenced during like the school day hours, so 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. Teenagers and children are also going to have autoplay turned off for videos, and I'm kind of excited about teenagers having the ability to switch off a setting that gives them an algorithmic, personalized sort of experience. And, you know, then we're also going to be able to increasingly see, you know, disabling of light counts and blocking teenagers from using all kinds of like extreme makeup filters and filters that like mimic cosmetic surgery. I am really, really excited about this. And I think the reason is because it is disturbing to me the degree to which we're giving children a worse start in life by not safeguarding their attention spans and taking that seriously. And I think I would feel differently if we weren't seeing across the board problems with, you know, school performance, with the decline of reading, with, you know, literacy rates dropping in this country, with curriculum moving away from expecting kids to read whole books and analyze the themes. You know, obviously, we've always had Cliff Notes. We've always had teenagers doing things that are bad for them. We've long had television. We've long had video games. We've long had all kinds of distractions. Also, hormones, right? The opposite sex is a little bit of a distraction for many teenagers, right? So like we've long had these vices available to teenagers, but we haven't had these vices in the form of little devices that they hold in their pockets and have constant access to, including in school settings, where it seems that teachers and parents have been really impotent and powerless to crack down on them. I wish that this had happened at, you know, more and more local levels. Like, I wish every parent across the country felt like they could actually parent and be empowered to never give the devices in the first place, to take them away if they're presenting problems, or to say, you can have a phone, but you can't take it to school and you can't be using it during school. But for whatever reason, people have really abdicated their responsibility there. And I think it's perfectly reasonable for, you know, these states to come to Meta and basically make the case of, you've created an addictive product for these kids, and we care a lot about age gating this and ensuring that we just have a little bit more control and the parents have a little bit more control to restrict how their kids use these things so that they use them in more age appropriate ways. I think that's a good thing.
I do not think that's a good thing at all. I don't, because what if, like, what right does the government have to do that if I think my 17-year-old is perfectly fine to use the technology as it exists? And if I accept... Let me finish. If we accept that the government has the right to say a 17-year-old cannot access news and information on this platform, How do we know they wouldn't do the exact same thing to books or any other mode of expression that you think would be more socially uplifting? Say that this program, this kind of news, this kind of information that is unhealthy for kids, we've decided it. There isn't convincing, persuasive, across-the-board evidence of it, but we've decided it because we bought into the theories of one prominent, powerful, very tech-savvy himself, social psychologist. And now we are determining for every 17-year-old in the country how much of this, how much reading, how much interacting with their friends, how much a consumption of news content is good for them. Not you, their parents, not you, their teacher, but we, the state. I think that is very dangerous.
So I think one of the things that's actually good about the way that this settlement in particular was structured, and this does not hold for all future settlements, but delving into the finer details of this, is that it actually seems like these states are increasingly forcing Meta to make it so that parents can basically, on their end, have more bespoke controls over what their kid can access. So I think obviously not every parent is going to avail themselves of that opportunity, but I actually think that that's a really good and nice thing that sort of in a sense restores some power to the parent making those decisions. I am in favor of more and more of that type of thing. And I think that Meta should basically work with these lawyers to try to come up with more solutions that look like that.
Yeah, well, they've also been asked to pay, what was it, $15 billion in settlement fees because these people who are now adults, they're now about my age, are claiming that they had been harmed by social media, they have been addicted by social media. The thing is, there is no evidence that these children are actually, you know, quote unquote, there is an addiction to this particular content, right? And what's interesting about these settlements is that they have tried in the past to sue companies like Meta based on the content. But there was already a ruling that said that these companies cannot be liable for the content that they themselves didn't upload. And so these settlements are based on the algorithms and the idea that these particular sort of technologies are effective by design. That's what they're claiming. And I do think that we've got to be very clear about the fact that all of these sort of the powers that parents have to control their children's access to social media have already existed. Before these lawsuits, they already existed. I have a 12-year-old sister who I manage the sort of social media access for, and I can do it from the US, literally 5 hours time difference, and I can control what social media she has access to, if any. I can control how many minutes she is allowed to spend on that particular platform. I can screen mirror to see exactly what it is that she is accessing. And that is something that Apple had already built into their systems. So I do think that there is a real risk here when we start blaming the platforms and blaming the technologies themselves and not blaming the parents who neglected their children and just allowed their children to access God knows what content online that may or may not have harmed them. But also, we don't talk enough about the massive, massive benefit to social media. And every time we restrict or control exactly what children are able to access, I do think we go into real dangerous territory. So the example that I think is really interesting to look into is what's happening in Australia, where they have introduced a government mandated ban on social media for under 16s. And a lot of these children are still accessing social media, but instead the algorithms think that they are over 18. And so they are accessing content that they otherwise wouldn't have accessed if the government hadn't intervened at all. And so what's interesting about this particular law is that what it has caused is these particular companies have then created algorithms that mean that these children are often accessing even more harmful content. And I do disagree with Liz on this idea that libertarianism is only for adults. I think that libertarianism is for everyone, and there is obviously restrictions to that. And I do think that we can be clear about the fact that an adult is different to a child. But also, I do think that a 14-year-old has the right to access political content and politically express themselves. And when the government intervene, or when these particular states are suing companies and forcing those companies to restrict what those children are able to access and when they're able to access it, on what terms they're able to access it, I think that that is, well, there is nothing libertarian about that at all.
Yeah, I'll come to you in a minute, Zach. Picking up on what you were saying about addiction, look, I certainly accept that a lot of people just like auto scroll, doom scroll the videos, and that eats up your time, and that can be a bad thing. If I was running a school, I would absolutely have like kids leave your phones in your lockers, like in the same way that I wouldn't let kids like play video play Game Boy back in my day, to age myself a little bit, instead of listening to their teachers. But when we start to say it's addictive in like a medical or psychological degree, I mean, last night I should have gone to bed on time, but instead I was addicted to, I put on another episode of Lost because we're rewatching Lost. Not okay, social
that
media.
That is an addiction you should be embarrassed by, Robbie.
And I'm deeply embarrassed. And I'll still defend the show.
Seek help.
But like, you know, leaving the TV on is kind of addictive. Is this, and the way they've gotten this lawsuit to succeed, right, is by claiming a novel amount of addiction having to do with these products that I just find not entirely persuasive. Not because they're not addictive at all, but because I don't think they're actually in a unique category of addictiveness the way that cigarettes are addictive and also give you cancer. This is a speech-related product.
With these particular children in this case, or at least they're adults now, and they're saying that they were unduly harmed by these algorithms and by these technologies as they were children, a lot of them also had a whole host of sort of other contexts in which they were neglected by their parents. And, you know, one of the girls in the case, I believe it was New Mexico, but I might be wrong on that. She was, you know, in the court proceedings saying that, you know, her mother would leave her sort of unmonitored for hours on end when she was a child, and she had access to all this content because of that reason. And I think that, you know, when we're looking into these particular cases, Mark Zuckerberg is not to blame for your mental health issues. Like, I think we have to be very brutal about this and be very clear about this and say, you know, yes, there may be content and maybe things out there that are harmful, but it is a parent's job to parent. It is not the state's job, the government's job to parent your child. And there may be content out there that is harmful, but there are also lots of communities online that are brilliant. I mean, the Australian example is interesting because there's been a lot of talk about LGBT kids who live in very conservative households, unable to access the communities online that they otherwise would have. And I think that that is undoubtedly a benefit to social media. It means that you're able to access communities that you wouldn't otherwise have. I personally grew up in a very restrictive Muslim household, and I was able to access communities of people online that were questioning that particular upbringing. And I think that that was a net good. And I'm 24 and I think I turned out okay.
Yeah, Zach, this is all personal for me because I just resent the idea that anyone anywhere is going to be blocked from seeing more of my commentary on the million and a half shows I host every day. Yes, this is outrageous.
They're
right.
To
consume me is being thwarted. What do you say?
Yeah, I think I kind of split the difference actually somewhat. I think it's a bad remedy for a real problem, which is early childhood and teen dependence on social media for social stimulation. And, you know, I take Liz's point about adults are treated differently by the state than children and should be in many different contexts. I think that's a lot easier when you're talking about carding someone at a liquor store than kind of like through the regulatory process, redesigning how a social media site works. And so like as a older millennial parent, I know you classified me at the kids table, Robbie, but I am firmly in the elder millennial zone.
It's okay. We love you anyway.
I've got three young kids and I'm going to put almost the entire onus to fix this problem on our shoulders, us millennial parents. You know, we were the guinea pigs for social media and smartphones in our adolescence. And I think most of us, myself very much included, are way too glued to our phones. And we need to model better behavior for our kids if we're going to be telling them not to be on their devices all the time. And that's a hard thing. You know, no government policy or lawsuits are ever going to fix this deeper problem. You can tinker around the edges and stop autoplay, but people are just going to be drawn to this. It's going to take a social movement. That's where I support Jonathan Haidt, even as I have questions about his political project. I'm fully in support of his social project and especially his partnership with Lenore Scanese, because I think that is the fundamental problem. This free range problem, lack of independence for kids and teens. That includes like the disappearance of places for them to go and hang out in person. And part of that actually is policy related, whether it's, you know, telling CPS not to call the cops on kids who are wandering around, or urban design, designing family and teen friendly spaces, just tolerating teenagers hanging out. There's all these cities and townships and HOAs that are like setting insane curfews so kids can't be kids and hang out. So all that is going to have a far bigger effect, I think, than telling Facebook or TikTok how its algorithm has to be designed, and also is going to be far less intrusive on the digital privacy and rights of adults.
Our beloved colleagues had their wonderful book about the libertarian moment many years ago, Nick Gillespie and Matt Welch. And I think, you know, you can debate the degree to which the libertarian moment came true in the way that they believed and hoped. It's possible the libertarian moment happened, and now it's unfortunately kind of gone. But one thing that I think is, you know, to Zach's point about Haidt and Scanese and the sort of social movement, one thing that I think is actually an example of, you know, green shoots that we should all be very excited about is the fact that a whole generation of parents, myself included, Zach included, are waking up en masse to the fact that we have really overprotected children in the real world and underprotected them in the virtual world. That's a Jonathan Haidt line. But this is something that Lenore Scanese has been talking about for so long. And I think to your point, Reem, about, you know, how exactly should we be thinking about these mental illness issues that have developed in these teenagers who are now adults? You know, what's the sort of causal mechanism there? I think it's actually very beautiful that the Haidt and Scanese approach, which I think is libertarian in a sense, it's socially very libertarian. I think it's beautiful that it's catching on the way that it is. And I think libertarians have a really big part to play in encouraging this cultural moment, even if we want to quibble over the specific legal mechanisms used. Because honestly, we don't want to have whole generations of teenagers who grow up super risk averse, super scared of interacting with people in the real world, failing to develop skills in school, failing to develop social skills. That's not good. I mean, maybe it could result in more libertarians, but no, I think it would be a really big problem, and we don't want to see that, right?
Yes. No, I think the difference between, you know, you can be a libertarian and that's your view on the state, but of course the cultural aspect of it, and, you know, you can be a libertarian and still have opinions about things. And I think that, of course, many libertarians do have lots of opinions about things, but also the cultural aspect of it, you know, if you believe that's it's the job of society, it's the job of a social movement, it's the job of a voluntary community to make those calls and decisions, but also influence parents on how they are protecting their children from the potential harms online, then I think that that's wonderful. And it's definitely something that I personally do with my younger sister. But also, I think that these particular lawsuits end up causing more harm than good.
Yeah, ultimately, the reason I come down so concerned about this, it's not because I think there are zero harms to people who use social media in excess, or that I'm saying it's not addictive at all. I'm not saying that at all. The issue is government coming in and making a rule for everyone when it's the case that, okay, a minority of users are abusers of the product. I mean, this would be true for anything. This gets into gambling or video games. Video games, something that at a very fundamental level has been determined by the Supreme Court to be a form of First Amendment protected speech, right? That was a decision authored by Antonin Scalia, by a conservative Supreme Court, litigated along very similar lines, that there were harms to children. And there they said, they recognize that it is consistent with the First Amendment to have a right, even for an underage child, to play violent video games. The state could not forbid that because it's a First Amendment right. Now, maybe here there are more cases of harm, or the harm argument is maybe it's more ends up being more persuasive. I still think it's operating at the level where I'm not persuaded by, because I find the data, I find that people's self-reported mental anxiety or depression rates over time as a statistic I am wary of. And ironically, the reason I'm wary of it is that I was convinced by the research of Jonathan Haidt that people will self-report, young people will self-report higher rates of depression and anxiety because that comes with a certain amount of cultural status on college campuses, and that the trigger warnings and safe spaces and the epidemic of people incredibly privileged and wealthy people identifying as easily triggered and emotionally unwell was because that is a social signifier.
It's social points.
Yeah, he was totally right about that. And then he turned around and said, and also I wholly believe that is a true phenomenon and it's the phones to blame, which
does this make you feel old, Robbie, that you went from being like, yes, yeah, Jonathan Haidt is right, to no, what, Jonathan Haidt, no, stop.
Yeah, I'm with the Jonathan Haidt of 2011.
It's not like the Jonathan Haidt. Old Kanye. I like the old Jonathan Haidt.
Right, right.
Jonathan, that's where I hipsters stand.
All right, that's good enough on that. The only other thing I maybe wanted to touch on today, a funny story to end on, Milo Yiannopoulos. Some of you out there may remember that name. That's to channel old Obi-Wan. That's a name we hadn't heard in a long time. Very much actually a figure of Jonathan Haidt era 1.0. Of the college campus speech freakouts, the deplatforming of him, of which I covered somewhat exhaustively at the time as an example of intolerant leftist students, you know, shouting down people like him and Christina Hoff Sommers and Heather McDonald and Ann Coulter and others who tried to speak on college campuses in the 2010s. He was then brutally canceled himself by conservatives. His book was canceled. He was denied a speaking opportunity, as it was revealed that a lot of the work he did for Breitbart was alleged to have been written by other people. I have often found him to be a kind of scamming type person. He's an immigrant from the UK. A fellow Brit who will be returning there after ICE deported him on the instructions of Laura Loomer, who has been feuding with him. This is an intra-MAGA feud. And she finally got ICE to say, he's over there. And they went and got him. He overstayed a visa. I guess we're supposed to be a little not happy about, you know, the state being weaponized against people for, you know, he became critical of Trump recently. On the other hand, I don't know.
Couldn't have happened to a nicer guy. Yeah.
I mean, it certainly couldn't have happened to a nicer guy. And also I presume that he did violate whatever the visa situation is.
Yeah. As hilarious as it is that the guy who tweets about needing to contain his orgasms watching ICE arrests got detained.
Oh, this is a family program.
You know, the poetic justice is too much
some
to
sick
handle.
Stuff.
I do find the Laura Loomer aspect of this like particularly disturbing. Maybe because I just interviewed Vinay Prasad last week, and he essentially confirmed to me that Laura Loomer cost him his job at the FDA like the first time that he got booted out. And so the fact that we're like living in Loomer's America possibly is just very unsettling. Just more generally, like these self-aggrandizing influencers actually have influence from a policy standpoint. And it seems that it's only getting worse in that regard. Yeah.
Liz, do we want an immigration system that is Laura Loomer decides?
We probably don't, but we could make a reality show out of it. Have you considered? Yeah. Especially if Milo Yiannopoulos is orgasming every single time the handcuffs get on him.
Oh, God.
This is definitely, you know, of all the possible futures that I could have imagined maybe like 10 years ago, this is like one of the dumber ones. Mm-hmm. But you know what? That's just very useful to incorporate into my mental model of projecting what the next 10 years will look like. Laura Loomer, maybe our first female president, right? It's anyone's game.
It's a massive shame that Milo has been deported back to a third world country. But of course, we have to be very, you know, very consistent about this. And of course, we don't want anybody to be sort of unduly targeted by the immigration system because they have been outspoken about the president. That is unfair. Although the one thing that I just keep asking myself is why would somebody who is so excited by deportations not try and make sure that he himself has legal status? Like, of all the people, I'm not, you know, I don't like these deportations, I think they're terrible. But of all the people you would expect to make sure they have their paperwork in order, it would be Milo, right? It would be the person that is always talking about how brilliant ICE is and how we need mass deportations. It's also like, what did you think mass deportations were for? Like, what did you think that they were going to result in? If you are
vibes, white papers,
visa,
essays.
Yeah, it's like, you know, if you are overstaying your visa and also have refused to turn up to court proceedings, and you are one of the people that are championing ICE, of course you are going to be deported. It just seems sort of obvious. And I'm like, why didn't you just sort your paperwork out?
Yeah, he is a deeply unsympathetic figure. Nevertheless, I feel a little bit sorry for him, which is because I'm a libertarian.
Because he's in Britain.
I don't like when people are targeted by the state. So even he has prompted me to shed maybe one or two tears.
I will say very quickly, I think that we probably will not hear the last of him, right? I mean, in the UK, he'll probably end up...
I truly hope we have, but...
Well, he'll be gallivanting with Rupert Lowe and Nigel Farage and, you know, all of the sort of right-leaning figures that are probably sympathetic to what he says. And he'll probably end up being, you know, he's big, sort of was big cheese here. He will be massive cheese in the UK.
I mean, he has declined into near irrelevance, I would say, in terms of the political discourse compared to where he was 10 years. So if this becoming a kind of free speech martyr, I'm not sure that exactly fits the situation, but somehow, you know, turns up the volume on his mic again, that would be a...
I mean, maybe he'll become anti-ICE activist.
Anti-ICE activist.
The left will embrace him.
There you go.
Maybe he did this unintentionally. Maybe he did this all as a massive PR stunt to make sure that he was relevant again. Maybe he wanted to go back to the UK and wanted the free plane ticket.
Yeah. I mean, probably. So much of this is just kabuki theater, right? Yeah. Like, all of this is performance. None of this is real.
Yeah. It is true that it's funny that it happened after his period of influence, but the influencer class that has become so important and I would argue fairly toxic and damaging to at least Republican politics or Republican comms and media. He was in some ways tailor-made for that, but peaked just a little too early before that wholly consumed Republican commentary. You're laughing at me for
thinking of the same joke right now, and no, neither of us are going to make it.
We're gonna move on. That's more words than we needed to say about Milo. Let's wrap this up with everybody's cultural product endorsement. It doesn't need to be an endorsement, just something you're consuming recently, broadly defined. In my rare appearances on the podcast, I think I've recommended some truly ridiculous things. Let's start with Zach.
Okay, well, I think I can recommend something fairly ridiculous. The Curry Barker's breakout hit Obsession has already been recommended on here, but I'm going to recommend going back into his YouTube archive, as well as the archive of Kane Parsons, who directed the other big hit, Backrooms. I'm just fascinated and really pleased by those back-to-back successes from Gen Z, this Gen Z YouTube first generation filmmakers. I thought both movies were excellent and original, and I'm really excited to see what they each do next. And I'm also hoping like other original voices emerge from that space now that they've kind of kicked down the gates. YouTube is just a great like open training ground for this, because they can kind of develop their voices and their vision independently, put it out there, hopefully get a little cash back to keep it going and like scale up slowly like that. It's a great lab. And so if you go back and watch their stuff, you know, all you have to do is go to YouTube, type in Curry Barker. The one I'll recommend in particular is The Chair, and you'll really see all the elements there for what would become his style and Obsession. And then Kane Parsons, interestingly, just dropped a new Backrooms edition like 2 weeks ago. So the guy went to Hollywood, but he's loyal to YouTube. He came back and he made a good kind of, you know, addition to the Backrooms lore, which of course started on 4chan and Reddit and became a whole like sort of crowdsourced thing that he distilled into a hugely successful movie. So that's my recommendation.
I am Backrooms pilled. I'm Backrooms maxing. Absolutely. I am just such an enthusiast of Kane Parsons. So I'm with you there. Reem, how about you?
Well, as part of my Reem's New to America and trying a bunch of American stuff, I am going to recommend the Monticello Thomas Jefferson House tour, which I think is, and I've been to a bunch of tours, I've been to lots of different historic places, but this is probably the best tour I've ever been on. And I think that one of the interesting parts of it is maybe it's just that my guide was really fantastic, but they really do understand exactly why Jefferson put specific things in specific places. And the house itself is beautiful. I mean, it really is gorgeous. It's in Virginia. The tour is amazing. But one of the aspects of it that I really, really enjoyed, which I don't know if it is a sort of a common thing that people know of Thomas Jefferson or not, but he would put statues of people he disagreed with opposite pictures of himself to remind himself that he enjoys the marketplace of ideas, the discussion with people that he disagrees with. So he had like a statue, an image of these like Russian czars that he disagreed with. He had famously, I think it was a picture of Hamilton, or maybe it was a bust of Hamilton's head. And this was all out in the sort of near the bedroom area of his house. And the woman was explaining, yeah, I mean, he just loved to be reminded every single day that, you know, we have differences and we enjoy having differences and we enjoy having disagreements. And he lived for that. And I think that what was really fascinating about that is I think we need a bit of that in American politics today. You know, we enjoy disagreeing and we enjoy having conversations with people that we disagree with, because at the end of the day, that is what the politics is, right? That is the polity, that is the sort of the discourse, and we can weed out the bad ideas in the marketplace of ideas and hopefully find the best ideas through arguments and through those particular sort of Socratic dialogues, if you will. So I really enjoyed the tour. I thought the house was beautiful. And also you could sign your name on the declaration, which was quite fun, with an actual sort of old pen with dipping it in ink. It was great. But the sort of free speech / enjoyment of the marketplace of ideas aspect of the house in Monticello is beautiful.
I keep a sculpture of Christian Brischke in my apartment. nude sculpture, obviously. Liz, what about you?
My recommendation is food by Whitney Aycock, the restaurateur in Rockaway in Queens, New York. In 2021, Whitney was arrested for alleged harassment of an ex-girlfriend. In 2017,
alleged.
He was arrested for cutting a hole in the wall of his old restaurant and stealing his old oven.
Due process.
In 2016, he was busted for growing weed at his Rockaway home, which then he tried to convince the feds was lemon verbena and catnip. He got in a ton of trouble back in 2017 for playing lewd music at one of New York's major public beaches. And then he, of course, had to argue with the cops for a long time and got into a criminal mischief situation. He got fined over the course of 2020, 2021, and 2022 for keeping his restaurant operational amid lockdown orders. The National Park Service hates him, NYPD hates him, and it's not totally clear how many other jurisdictions he has angered in the last few years, but I must say, he's kind of a wild fisherman. He's accumulated a crazy rap sheet, and we love him. He had a little pizza pop-up this past weekend, and my whole family had pizza, some tuna crudo from a tuna that I guess he just randomly caught a few days ago. He's crazy. He smokes cigarettes while he prepares your food. He doesn't take anything other than cash. It's not clear to me that he's ever paid taxes. I deeply love this guy. His name is Whitney. He haunts the Rockaway Peninsula in New York. If you ever go down to the beach in New York City, I can't recommend him highly enough. May the libertarian iconoclast live forever.
You made me want to come to New York, which is not a feeling I ever have. I haven't been there in a while, but maybe we can go next time I'm there.
I'll take you tuna fishing with Whitney.
Fantastic. I'm going to recommend a book people may have heard of before. It's called The Three Musketeers. Every now and then, I try to go back and read a piece of literature I should have read as a literature major, but for some reason just like missed. And this is one of them. I am reading it right now. It's great. I know the basic outline of the story, and probably most people listening do as well. But it just involves a lot of men, young men, just getting into fights with each other constantly, something that doesn't really happen anymore. In this feminized world we live in, I don't know, it's probably a good thing actually because they do hurt themselves a lot. But you walk up to another gentleman and that gentleman's fighting with other gentlemen and you just challenge them to fight and you fight each other. And that seems like what was going on in France at the time. Not sure if there's a broader kind of lesson in there, but we have lost in a good way the likelihood of just engaging in and encountering constant physical violence with other people. It's a fun read so far. I'm enjoying it. All right, thank you all for listening to this special Oops All Robbie's and Liz's and Reams and Zach's edition of the Reason Roundtable. We hope it was fun, but you will be back to your regularly scheduled programming, I believe, next week. And for now, we'll see you later.